Yes, so welcome to this week's episode of How to Be Hopeful, a podcast all about hope, how to find it and how to keep hold of it once you've found it. My name's Bernadette Russell and I'm really excited this week to be speaking to Jess from Trees for Cities. She'll introduce herself to you shortly. I just wanted to say that my humble association with Trees for Cities and the little bit I'm able to do is one of my sort of proudest achievements, and you'll hear Jess and I talk about it a little bit more, but it's a fantastically hopeful, positive and active and frequently exhausting and muddy endeavour to plant a tree. So hopefully this chat that you hear will persuade you to do so if you haven't done already. Hello, Jess.
Hello.
How are you? Would you just introduce yourself to everyone?
Yes, my name's Jess Masuko. I'm the Community Engagement Manager at Trees for Cities, which is an urban tree planting charity based in London.
Brilliant. And we're going to go into a little bit about more about what Trees for Cities is and how it started, etc. But before we start, as you know, this podcast is about hope, sometimes difficult to find at these tricky times. But I wondered if there might have been anything this week or in the last 7 days, Jess, that's made you feel hopeful.
Oh, well, you know what, actually, I did visit a close friend on the weekend and she's just had a baby, so that's kind of it's an easy win, isn't it? Such a sweet, really, really chubby baby, and yeah, it was just an absolute delight. She gave birth over lockdown, and I did manage to go and see her in the garden when she was inside the house, and I cycled over from I live in northeast London, she lives in Forest Hill. It literally took me about 3 hours. I cycled across London, and I'm quite new to cycling in London as well, so it took me so long. I got there, I was overjoyed, it was raining slightly, I was in the garden, she handed me out some hummus and pita bread. Anyway, that was a while ago, and then I went to go visit the baby again and her over the weekend, and it was super nice. That definitely fills me with hope.
That's so lovely. As you were saying it, I was thinking, what, chubby babies are the best babies, first of all. They're amazing, and they're sort of really... but yeah, it's such a privilege to see tiny, tiny babies. They're kind of amazing, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
And how's your friend doing? Because, of course, the baby's going to be none the wiser, but how's she doing? Because I'd imagine that's had its challenges for her.
It was great. She was so excited to have the baby. It had been some time coming, and I'm really proud of her. And it was quite funny, actually, because her partner came down and they really told me the entire birth story. And I just loved it because I really want to know all the details, because that's the thing about life, isn't it? It's not... This is such a funny story to start off this podcast with, but it's true. It's not all easy. There's some grisly detail.
No.
But you need to know, and you need to embrace them and also find the humour in them sometimes, because obviously the result was this lovely little girl. So,
absolutely. Yeah. No, I totally agree. We need to hear it all. I think that's why, because I often, when I chat to people and they'll say to me, I'm struggling to find something hopeful, I think that's part of it, is being honest and truthful, including actually the birth was really messy or difficult all along, if it was, or you know, this week's been a bit terrible. It's kind of being it for us all to be able to share everything with each other, I think, actually helps lead you back to hope. If you're allowed to sort of express the fact that something was difficult,
yes,
you can find your way through it, can't you? So, well, that's so lovely. And what's the baby's name?
Robin.
Oh my goodness.
I know. Isn't that lovely? R-O-B-Y-N.
That's
really
so
sweet.
Great. Oh, so this is Robin. Robin's hope. So as you said, you're part of the amazing team for Trees for Cities. Jess, could you talk a little bit about, this is my nosiness, I'm going to be honest, about what your background is and how your sort of journey and what you did before you joined Trees for Cities?
I've actually got quite a good story with this, because I sort of started at Trees for Cities as a volunteer. Did you know this?
No!
Ages ago, in 2010, I went to university and I graduated. I studied English. I don't know if you know that either. So, classic arts student. I really wanted to do something positive, useful. I found this internship at Trees for Cities and I applied. I got it. I spent 3 months with the organisation. This is when I was 21. I'm 31 now, so it's literally 10 years ago. And I loved it, and it really set me up. I wanted to do a variety of other things after that, but it really sort of paved the way. So the fact that I returned there is quite interesting. After I did that, I was really fascinated with Eastern Europe for some reason when I was younger. So I moved to Ukraine for a few months, and I was working with these students on this environmental awareness campaign. And then I did a whole bunch of projects in Armenia, and I lived in Hungary for a summer. I ended up working for this environmental youth network called Youth and Environment Europe in Prague, where I lived on an urban farm. It was great. I was having the time of my life, honestly. And that was basically a network of lots of small grassroots groups run by young people or students or anyone under the age of 30, essentially. And they would come together and do these projects and campaigns around biodiversity and ecological sustainability and all that sort of thing. So I had a great time in but when I was 25, I thought, okay, I want to come home, came back to London, really wanted a job like the one that I have now. But it does take a while sometimes to get these sorts of jobs. So if anyone's listening and is interested in doing this sort of thing, you just have to be persistent because they're like gold dust. So I was applying. I ended up working in a secondary school in Mile End, which was actually an experience I would never, I'm really, really glad I did it. I was an SEN support worker, so working with these teenagers with a variety of needs. And then I actually spent, I think it was only 3 or maybe 4 months in a pupil referral unit. I have never learned so much as I did in that PRU in Bermondsey. Excuse me. Honestly, it was a real experience. And whilst I was doing that, I was also volunteering with the Conservation Volunteers, another fantastic environmental charity. They do loads of projects all over the country. And I was working on a food growing project with young offenders on the weekends as a volunteer growing food for a local refugee centre. So
That's
it was all just
amazing.
really, amazing stuff. I feel so privileged, obviously. I've had really good opportunities to pursue a career in the charity sector, which isn't something many people don't feel like it's necessarily a route, and that's something which needs to be addressed because, it's, you do have to volunteer a lot, which means you maybe need more of a financial sense of stability and so on. But I've ended up at Trees for Cities. I've been there nearly 5 years now.
That's amazing. Thank you. I'm so glad I asked you that question because actually we've known each other a couple of years, haven't we? And I don't think I knew any of that. So it's amazing what an incredible journey and really sort of interesting different chapters of that of your book so far. So really great. And in terms of what you do now, Jess, could you explain that and what your role is at the moment within Trees for Cities for listeners so they understand what it is you actually do?
So we have two main programs, our schools program, which includes our edible playgrounds program, which is where we build these fruit and vegetable growing gardens in schools. I did actually also work on that program when I first joined, which was really fantastic. You go into schools and you support the teaching staff to teach the children outdoors in this space, and the kids love growing kale and stuff. It's just fantastic, these inner city kids. I actually now work purely on the urban forest program, so that's tree planting. We plant in parks, housing estates, recreation grounds, anywhere really that we can. We partner with local authorities almost entirely, so they're the boroughs of London. We also have a UK programme, but I don't work on that one. And we try to plant with local people and with volunteers, anyone who's interested. That's a big part of it. We're an environmental charity, but also very much a social charity. It's about encouraging people to access nature, use their local green spaces, all of this, of course, really important, especially during lockdown. And I also see it as sometimes people's first step into environmental action. It's a very accessible, fun thing, tree planting. It's very family friendly. I think people see it as a kind of bucket list thing. But actually, it also does introduce you to this whole world of conversation about air pollution, climate change, biodiversity loss, how green space isn't equal, and how some communities and some people don't have access to the green space that they deserve and need. All these sorts of things.
It really does. I mean, I know from the planting days that I volunteered at that the things that are you've expressed as ambitions happen. You know, you'll have, you know, I've been in groups of people where it's for the first time one amazing thing that's happened is often people meet their close neighbours for the first time. And yes. I find that really moving and beautiful. And it's very playful and lighthearted because we're covered in mud and, you know, doing our best. And everybody's wearing sort of strange wellies. And the other thing is the conversations that spring up about, the climate crisis, what people, you know, and people swapping ideas about small actions that can be taken. All of those things happen very naturally and easily whilst someone's digging. And also I think what's so important about what you do is people feel such a massive sense of achievement. Instead of feeling despairing because they see all this terrible news, that's still there, but they can be like, but I've just planted this hazel tree or I've just planted this. So I think it's absolutely brilliant. As you know, I'm a big fan. But what I want to do is, because I think this is a great story as well, and I know you'll tell it better, could you talk to us a little bit about the very beginning of Trees for Cities? Because I think its sort of incarnation is brilliant and how it started. How it began.
I'm not sure if I'll do it justice, but it's such a great story. It's basically a group of friends in London. It definitely started down the pub, and they were people who liked to party, and I think they had this idea of just throwing these parties and doing a bit of fundraising for trees as well. And I think actually one of the original Board of Trustees described it as an idea that got out of control, and it suddenly became this entire organisation. It's great though, because the people who were, I mean, I've made so many good friends at work, honestly. It's really been a great place to work, and there is a sense of celebration. People do like to celebrate and party, and this idea of coming togetherness has definitely continued throughout. I think it's quite a young charity. I mean, there's obviously environmentalism. This is a big topic of conversation. Like, environmentalism belongs to everybody. And actually, some of the groups which are least represented in the sector are the ones who are the most passionate and the most grassroots active across the world. But there is this kind of idea that there are a lot of older people that are more active in conservation across the country and so on. Trees for Cities does for some reason attract a lot of younger people as well as everyone, but it does have this kind of youthful, playful energy about it that I think has continued from the origin the origin story.
I loved it when I think Seb first told me that. I love the idea of this joyful endeavour starting, popping up out of a party. It just really made sense, because you are quite, you know, party people. So what at the beginning, as far as you're aware, Jess, what kinds of things did Trees for Cities do right at the beginning when they started out, when they tumbled out of the pub?
You know what, I do know that they were actually beginning to do street trees and some quite interesting, more difficult types of planting. We've definitely grown in terms of scale. That goes without saying. So some of these huge projects we do these days, generously funded through a variety of funders, and they are big. But planting a single tree on a street still does take quite a lot of coordination and energy. So I think it started off with smaller, much smaller framed projects. As you know, for everyone listening, we have two types of tree. There's heavy standards, which is large trees, and the little ones, the saplings, we call whips. So I imagine it was largely the heavy standards, the bigger trees that were being planted. But yeah, it's a whole variety of things. And then the first schools project, I think, started happening around the time that I was interning in 2010. Mm-hmm. And then that's developed into this huge, like, schools program. I believe last year they did 100 edible playgrounds. Mm-hmm. And there's just so many being designed and built now.
And with the edible playgrounds, Jess, the kids are growing things they can eat, and do they then take the food home? Do you know how that works?
It's really dependent on the school. Yeah. I think this is a big point about the whole program. It relies very much on the leadership of the school, and there are some amazing head teachers out there. I really respect teachers. As I said at the start, I did work in a secondary school for about a year. They work so hard. The amount of responsibility, not just academically, but in terms of safeguarding, well-being, mental health, everything, looking after these children. Every child needs an equal amount of care. And to do all of that and then take on another project like this edible growing garden outdoors, it really does require the senior leadership of the school to create that space and to change the teaching methods slightly so that staff can accommodate it and use it to their advantage. So schools do a whole variety of things. Some of them really use it educationally. Some of them end up being used a lot more as an enrichment space for special education needs children or children who need that kind of relaxation area. Some of them have really good growing gardens. I was a coordinator for a school in Newham that had a wonderful teacher there, and she would do the markets for the parents where they would sell the produce that they did, and they did sell it and people bought it, and then they would invest it back into the garden. So, and sometimes they cook with it. It is a whole mixed bag.
Yeah, that's really great. Now, I'm interested because I'm connected with the Schools Trees project in Uganda, and they have sort of the same sort of variety of experience. That's great. And the other thing, of course, you mentioned before, you do these huge planting days. And just for someone listening that just mentioned heavy standards, which is basically if you plant a heavy standard, well, there's a tree. So it's got that. It's nice for that, isn't it? It's like there's immediately a tree. But what I think is fantastic about the planting whips, the smaller saplings, is you can kind of plant like a forest in a day with enough people, can't you?
Yeah, it is really interesting. I mean, our staff who have studied urban forestry for many years, we do they teach us how it works. And it's taken me a while to really get my head around it. But we plant a lot of young trees all together, close together, and it's supposed to mimic the way trees do this naturally. So if you go into the countryside and you've got a big oak tree, you'll notice that there are lots of baby oaks all around it. Obviously, they won't all survive into large oak trees. The idea is that they support each other. And there's been lots of discussion about this recently, like great books coming out that talk about how trees connect and speak to each other and so on underneath. So that's the idea. They kind of create their own little microclimate. They support each other. And then the strongest ones will survive. The ones that just naturally die off will just become mulch. And they enrich, go back into the ground. So yes, you are creating this woodland habitat. And then more importantly, you're also securing that space so that it's not going to be built on or changed. So even just putting trees there, it does, like, it sort of saves it for a while. It's a really good way of reclaiming that space. And then natural regeneration will also follow with the species. It's a long, long process.
So what does that mean? Natural
regeneration, just when the trees self-seed naturally.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. And I guess you've seen or noted, it just changed people's relationship with the place. One, if they've planted, but also I think, certainly from what I've seen, I don't know if you'd agree with this, Jess, that there's a different response to just a load of grass to a big, beautiful clump of trees that you might have planted yourself. There's a very different relationship. Not that, obviously, sometimes it's really nice to have grass because you can play footy on it or whatever, but it's an interesting change, I think. And I've certainly seen people revisiting their trees that they planted or taking photos of their trees. So I think that's really lovely. When you go into a space, do you talk to the local community and
Definitely. This is a big part. My job is really twofold. It's engaging people before the planting and then engaging people with the planting. Engaging with the planting is much easier. Talking to people before the project happens is really complicated. We're obviously quite restricted with time frames, as these things are. And a lot of the decisions have already been made and signed off by the funder, by the landowner, which is typically the council. All these people have kind of got involved. But we also need to check with the residents that they're happy with it. Sometimes there are very specific questions that we'll ask. If we're doing a greening project on a housing estate, for example, this is really people's back gardens. So you need to include them in what's going on and even allow them the chance to be involved in the design work. So, for example, we've got a project. I don't think you've visited this one. It's out in Ealing. It's a housing estate. And we got a good grant from the lottery to cover a multi-year program there. We've been there for 3 years already. I think we're going to be there for another 3 years. It's a massive housing estate. Thousands of people live there. It used to be a pony racing track. Yeah, Yeah, it's really cool. So all the streets are called, named after the different the racing tracks and so on. And
Wow.
it's shaped really interestingly. There's a lot of grass verges there. So we've planted 160 large trees there already, a lot of fruit trees. And that was fairly simple because we invited people to say if they wanted a tree. On a big map in the leisure centre, we reached out to loads of community groups, the local church, the local mosque, or whoever's around. We ask them what they would like. People put forward if they wanted one. We tried to put one there, but then you have to go and check with all the residents to make sure that they're okay with it. Some people don't want a tree outside their flat for a variety of reasons, and we definitely listen to that. And if they really don't want it, we just wouldn't plant it there. We find another space. So we've done that, and now we're developing these gardens, more courtyards, community gardens. It is a bit more complicated. COVID has thwarted our plans somewhat, but we found a way.
Very
So
good.
we've gone out and we created, my colleague Anna created this lovely, Anna, don't you? Yeah. She made this lovely activity called an imagination trail that people could sort of do self-led. So we printed out a little map of the courtyard area, and then we got colourful cones and rope and various things and ribbons, and they had to go from one zone to the next, and then they were led on this kind of journey of imagining what it could be. So the cones were representing potential fruit trees, or the ribbons represented potential climbing vines up the fence, and then they could say what they thought about that. And most of the time, people who actually engage are fairly positive. A lot of the time, they don't have many opinions, and I think that's because it's quite a new exercise for them. They've never, no one's really asked them before. Or you get people who are really, really know what they want. Then we'll feed that all back to our design team, and they will try to incorporate things into a sensible design that works for everyone. Then that needs to be signed off by the landowner. So it's an interesting process, but when we do some other projects, there's really not much room for people to input their thoughts. So I always try and do something that can engage them, even if it's just voting for their favourite trees that could go in, because it allows people the opportunity to input a little bit.
It's really lovely that you do all that work on just checking with people. I mean, even if people don't have much to say, I think it's really beautiful and important to check in. Also,
Yes.
sometimes those things need thinking about. I was just thinking, if someone asked me, I might just want to think about it, which is also great as well to have the invitation to consider that. This is a quick, hopefully a quick one to answer. Do you know how many trees you've planted so far?
Yes, because I think which planted all the years of blood into one. I've got to that age where I can't really remember. But I think it was the year before last. We planted our 1 millionth
I
tree.
thought so, yeah.
And we did it outside St. Thomas's Hospital in Westminster with Sir Michael Palin
That's
and some
so
children.
great. Right.
It was great, yeah. So it's been a lot. It's been a lot of trees. But interestingly, I think a lot of the team and myself included, we're quite keen to veer away from tree numbers. I mean, this is just the world, in terms of funding, government policy, all these targets and so on. It is about the tree numbers, but really it's about canopy cover. How much area are you covering with the canopy? Because as I was explaining, we plant a lot of little trees. They won't all grow up to be really mature trees, obviously. Some of them won't, but it's really about the amount of space in which you're eventually going to be covering with the leaves, and that is all about how much habitat you're creating and how much carbon you can absorb.
Oh right, well, that's really interesting. I'm slightly cringing because I've just done some really heavy pruning on my fuchsia and cut down its canopy quite a bit. But I did that really because I thought it kind of needs cutting back just to
Oh
encourage it a
yeah.
little bit. But
Oh yeah.
yeah, but no, that's really interesting. I think it's really important to recognise that the canopy is important. But I guess the number, although I hear you, that's not the most important thing. For you, it's very encouraging as a
Yes,
person that
yeah,
as a
that's what I
volunteer, just to
mean.
know what groups of volunteers and charitable organisations are capable of. It's extraordinary, isn't it? That number is great. It's really fantastic. If it's not too broad, I'm just going to ask you this, and it is a big broad question. But why would you say, for Jess, for you, is planting trees a good thing?
I think planting a tree, trees are very symbolic. that's probably why it came out of the pub conversation from the founders. It's a very symbolic thing. Everyone knows what a tree is, and most people have an opinion on a tree. Most people can name at least a couple of trees. And I think in cities, they do. And London is one of the greenest cities in the world, I believe, already. But we always need them. I think that it is such a simple thing, but people really do understand. You know what? When we go into schools to do these projects, I've really noticed how a lot of the classes were named after different trees. Just a standard. Have you noticed that as well?
I've noticed that, a few times now.
Yeah, it's such a classic thing. I think trees really capture the imagination in almost every culture. And we do take it for granted. So you'll go into a school and there'll be the oak tree and the holly tree class and all this sort of thing. And the children will therefore know at least the name of one tree. And therefore it does act as a brilliant stepping stone into environmental action and into nature. And from there, you can actually engage inner city teenagers with worms, which they're all completely terrified of. But you can get to that point. Or you can start talking about healthy eating and the fact that fruit is so expensive in the supermarket sometimes, and you can hopefully get it for free if you can go and forage and all this kind of thing. I think it acts as a great stepping stone into a huge variety of other topics.
Yeah, I think I'm interested in the kind of group activity of planting a tree as well, literally having a group of people, like I said to you, I witnessed people who'd met their neighbours for the first time. Do you think there's also something about that that's beneficial on a sort of social level?
Yes, I definitely do. I always find it really interesting because I'm involved in a variety of different environmental movements and so on. And there is always this concern that it's not diverse in the environmental sector. But I just don't find that at work at Trees for Cities. The people who turn up, it is the most, it's almost cheesy, it's ridiculous. It's almost like people from all different corners of the earth are holding hands around a tree and like...
Yeah,
it is actually like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I've probably told you this, but on one of the very big planting days when I was being a planting supervisor in my group, I had a group of Bulgarian builders who were also part of a choir who were teaching Bulgarian songs, a group of elderly Sikh marathon runners who are trying to learn the Bulgarian songs, and a group of every kind of nationality, ethnicity, etc. of scouts, then some sort of local born and bred from generations back London, every kind of person in my group, and it became part of the conversation, and we started having these really interesting conversations about journeys, where people had journeyed from, whether that was they just moved from Hastings or whether they'd come here from Bangladesh. And that was really lovely, actually, and just came out. So I agree, because I'm involved with environmental groups as well, and I hear and understand, and I think that conversation around sort of diversity and inclusivity is really important. But you're right, it does not apply to Trees for Cities. It's everyone.
Yeah, I always like to say it because I think sometimes there's this idea that there's only a certain type of person that's interested, but that is not true. As we know, there are much more important reasons around opportunity, privilege, history, everything else that stops people from perhaps doing various things. But when it comes to a simple action like coming out on a Saturday to plant a tree with your family and friends or by yourself, because we get a lot of people who come alone as well, and it's everybody. Everyone, and that's so nice to see. And I always thought as well, the fact it's such a physical activity, a lot of the time you're actually quite out of breath. So like the coming togetherness and the sense of belonging is, you don't necessarily even need to be talking to get that sense of unity, which is really nice as well.
Yeah, there's something about shared purpose that, you're right, goes beyond having to share words. I just mentioned that because it was particularly amusing. It was such a sort of lively, funny group of people. It's really nice.
Yeah, it's a great anecdote.
Yeah. And specifically, Jess, if you don't mind getting into it a bit, how does a tree, let's say a fully grown, mature oak tree, how does that benefit the environment? How does that, what does a tree provide?
It provides habitat. and food for a whole variety of species. And that alone is really important because we're facing a biodiversity crisis. It also provides beauty and a sense of place for people. I think that's really important. It provides shelter, it cools the air, it cleans the air. There's a whole program of work around sustainable urban drainage systems, because as we know, even this week, I feel like we've had all the rain at once. I mean, the weather is just a whole other topic that it would be interesting to discuss, but trees are also a really good tool for preventing flooding. So they're used in a very technical, clinical, engineering sense. They're used in a very warm, emotional, symbolic sense. And they're used for things that don't have anything to do with us. Well, they do, but like all the insects and things. And actually, that's quite an interesting conversation in itself, because unfortunately, a lot of our native trees are prone to pests and diseases these days, but they're the ones that really support a whole host of wildlife in this particular habitat. So oak has oak processionary moth, ash dieback people might be familiar with, you've got the horse chestnut beetle miner. There's loads of things going on, and it does mean that we plant a mixture of native and non-native trees for resilience. And then climate change is just making everything even worse along there. So it's not only just a sense of community and making a park more beautiful. It's an ongoing experiment in what we can plant to really support for the future.
Yeah. What can we do, as in, like, when I say we, I mean regular, ordinary people who might have, let's say, who might have a tiny little London-sized garden. Is it worth planting a tree in your garden if you haven't got one? And what are good sort of smallish-sized trees that...
You know what? I think if you really don't have a lot of space, I do think that herbs and flowering shrubs and stuff are probably the best, because they're so good for pollinators.
Yeah.
And I think most people know about the decline in bees. That's been quite well publicised. But just generally, the lack of... it's the pesticides for sure, but it's also the lack of food and habitat for pollinators. So providing that, when you walk past a lavender bush, there is always about 20 bumblebees on it.
Yeah, Jess,
I don't know where they come from.
My garden was literally buzzing and alive with bees, because I've got a massive fuchsia. It's like the size of a... Yeah. Oh, it's huge. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And loads and loads of lavender. And you would... In my garden, you would never know there was an issue with bees. It's like all of the bees are there.
They find it. I think growing those sorts of things, because, you had to prune back your fuchsia, which is completely fine. They're much easier to maintain than a tree. You can cut them back. They will kind of grow back. You can shape them. You can fit them. You can grow them in a pot if you need to. Then you can literally pick it up. If you're a tenant or you're going to move house, you can take it with you. So growing those sorts of things, I think, is really valuable. Trees are a little bit more complicated. You want to make sure that you're growing a small size tree, or the correct size tree for the space. You want to make sure that you're considering other things in the immediate area. So it's worth doing quite a lot of research. But I think if you've only got a bit of space or just a windowsill, growing those sorts of herbs and flowering plants, for sure.
Those are really good tips, because I think a lot of people listening to you, and a lot of people, will have seen recent interviews with David Attenborough, for example, or his documentary, mm-hmm. etc., his film, and it's a bit discouraging, because you just think, well, I really want to help, but what can I do? And I think it's great to have things like that. Put some lavender in a pot, take it with you if you move, because at least people can feel they can do something. Because you're on the sort of the front line of this, Jess, is it tough sometimes for you to stay hopeful about sort of environmental things? How do you sort of manage? How do you manage?
Yeah.
I was just thinking that when I heard you talking about being aware of disease, being aware of weather, being aware of climate change, that you are, because of the nature of your work, which is incredibly positive and hopeful, you're also in the line of fire of quite a lot of possibly alarming news.
But I think that's where I need to be at the moment. I'm in a position now where I
have the capacity to do that. And I think I know I'm being useful doing that. I mean, we had the driest spring on record or something, you know, they're always the driest on record. We had an incredibly dry spring over lockdown. I don't know if you remember, but in May it was already like 30 degrees. Had a big impact on our projects this year. We're adapting, we're, you know, restocking if we need to, we're doing all these things. It is pretty heartbreaking. I sometimes do feel really overwhelmed with it, but then we have to remember that this is real. I think especially in this country, things like climate change, we know it's real, but we really don't feel it. And I think it's important for us to know that sometimes things will fail or, you know, things will be struggling. We're really looking at all of our watering. I mean, we had to, for our large trees, those heavy standards, we did really well. We didn't have losses. The team had to go out once a week, which is far more than we're contractually obliged to do or necessarily funded to do, but we were just upping the watering rounds because we knew that it was very necessary. We had all that big heat wave in spring, which was the worst possible time for it to happen because it's when all the leaves are really fresh and they're still, you know, and then August, it was really, really hot again. And then of course, even like in September, we had more heat waves, didn't we? It was just really intense. And then the rain is coming all at once, which isn't necessarily great because it just runs off.
Yeah.
Can't necessarily be absorbed. And there are serious conversations happening in the ARB world about species selection and what we're going to do about this. Because as I was alluding to before, yes, we could just plant species that can cope with different weather, hotter, drier weather, longer spells. But they're not necessarily what our native insects and wildlife need for habitat and food. So it's really, it's a real wake-up call. But I kind of think it's interesting thinking about hope. I remember when it was lockdown, obviously really stressful and confusing time for all of us. And I was very aware that a lot of our projects needed more water than we were probably able to provide. And it was kind of heartbreaking in some senses. And I was really worried about it. Then I was thinking, but actually, I already know that this is partly why we're planting them in the first place. We're investing so much in green infrastructure because of all of this stuff that we're battling, and this is the reality. So you just kind of have to look at it head on and think, right, well, at least you can see what's going on and then you can continue to try. So we're into our planting season again now. We actually started it earlier than we usually did because of COVID. We were trying to negotiate around another lockdown. So we started earlier and we're watering the trees more, the ones that we're just putting in now. And you just have to really like go for it. I think you can't be disheartened completely because of this. It just proves even more why we need to plant trees and why we need to green cities as much as possible. And when I think about the flooding that affects a lot of the country, mm-hmm. It's very serious. I mean, I was looking at even in Italy and France, people have died recently in the last week because of the floods. And trees can actually really support with that. But it's just about investing, isn't it? Investing time and energy and hope into these green infrastructure programs.
I think so, yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. It feels really important to, as far as you can, and because it requires courage and a kind of strength and resilience that you don't always have access to, but as far as you can, face the reality and the facts of what's going on and then seek a solution, which you have done individually and you are doing as an organisation. As you were talking, Jess, I was just thinking, again, people listening who aren't attached to an organisation, I guess people could help by just checking out on their local street trees in terms of watering.
Oh, yes.
Could you talk people through that a bit, how they might be able to support trees near them?
Yes, we actually were trying to encourage people to water a street tree. Street trees particularly, because if you think about it, they've got their little pit and then they're just surrounded by tarmac.
Yeah.
And who knows what else. Watering a tree outside your house, please be careful, anyone listening. You know, make sure that you're very aware of all the cars coming and going. Stay on the pavement. Make sure you don't. Sometimes there's all sorts of things, sharps and dangerous things that are in the tree pit. So just be really vigilant. Children should do it with family. Wear gloves if necessary. But yeah, watering, especially maybe in the evening when it's a bit cooler. Because if you water first thing in the morning, then it's probably going to evaporate quite quickly. But it does make a difference. I remember one of my colleagues saying that he was going to water this line of trees that we planted in the street somewhere in London. They were all alive, they were all doing well. There was one that looked amazing. And he said it's because there was this lovely little old lady who lived opposite the tree, and she'd been coming out and giving it additional water. Oh. So even though they were all alive and they were all green, but there was one that he just said it looked so rich. And it did, it really made a difference. So that's great. I mean, I know my borough does a adopt a pit scheme as well, where people can kind of take ownership of their pit and they can plant some, you know, wildflowers or something around there. That's quite a nice thing to do. And I think just being aware of your surroundings and aware of the trees definitely does make a difference.
And Jess, just practically, pardon my my ignorance about this, but should we be watering our street trees all year round? Is that an all year round thing, or is it noticing when they're dry, and also how much water?
Yes, okay, so spring, summer, absolutely. Winter is probably fine. I reckon we're going to get a really wet winter anyway. Also, most trees, deciduous trees at least, they kind of go into their dormant stage then, so they don't need as much. Spring, that's when, if you think about it, they're putting all of their energy into creating these new leaves. And in the summer, if they're fruiting, all of that energy and the extra water needs to go into the apple, for example. That's when they need the most water, not just because it's hot, but because they're actually need it, they need more stuff, energy. But then, yeah, throughout, I mean, if you wanted to, but I really think it's in from spring throughout into really late summer, early autumn now. And then how much water? I've actually asked this question several times because, and I it's really quite confusing. I don't actually know the answer. I think one of my colleagues would probably be able to give a specific amount, but it is a lot. So as I said, it's more important if you can just go out with a jug to do it at the end of the day when it's not going to immediately evaporate off, and then just put it right there, and then it will seep down.
And even a jug's better than nothing, isn't it? And I'm guessing that those times of years that you mentioned as well, the spring and the summer in particular, regularity is probably really helpful as well, isn't it? Regularly doing it, and then you'll get a happy tree like that older lady had. Just to go back a little bit, I was sort of interested in this, in the connection between, I don't know whether you'd agree with this, Jess, that more and more people are engaging with the conversation about the climate crisis, and more people are engaging with considering their impact on the environment, possible changes that they might be able to make. That feels like a genuinely growing thing. And I wondered if you've noticed a difference in terms of attitude in general, and whether that's impacted the number of volunteers that you've had in the last couple of years, either in this in any way, whether there might have been more, or whether you've noticed that conversation happening more.
I did notice more uptake on our engagement, actually, but I wasn't sure if that was just because Trees for Cities is growing as a charity. It's definitely, I mean, yeah, the conversation is changing from when I was a child, for sure. We were being, you know, told not to litter. And now it's like, can you tell, you know, giant corporations not to litter? The conversation has changed slightly. I think that there is more acceptance and people do. Air pollution as well. I think that that's a really interesting one because it's something people in cities can feel themselves. And there is a huge concern over children breathing in really bad air pollution. So that's because that's a little bit closer to home. There are some themes which you can see are picking up traction and people can connect the dots and they're trying all sorts of things to improve it. But I think time will tell. I think there's still probably a few leaps and bounds to happen in our society. I don't know how you feel. I feel like in the next couple of years, we're going to actually see even more of a shift.
I think it's really important. Seb's spoken to me about, Seb, who I should say is your colleague who features in my book. He was speaking about how it's also important that people don't feel it's their individual responsibility, and it might be great to decide to try and be vegan on a Tuesday, but it's not your fault, and that actually it's really important that we keep the pressure up on the organisations, the corporations and governments who aren't doing enough as well, so that we don't all sort of tear our hair out in grief and blame or blame each other when actually there are bigger things afoot. Do you think?
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. I really do. And actually, I mean, that's personally, I agree with that. But professionally, it's been quite interesting because one of the things we're really trying to do is connect with the landowners who are the local authority. So this is local government. And there is more funding coming in due to climate, you know, this climate emergency response money. And tree planting, because it's cheaper, it's one of the cheaper things. I mean, 100% really valuable, but it is a bit cheaper than, you know, maybe looking at different energy sources and stuff like that. It is getting through more funding, and you can see that, and there are more councils signing up with Trees for Cities specifically because they've signed a climate emergency declaration and things like that. So that's quite an interesting change, actually, that is connected to that, not the individual, but the society and the, you know, the established ways in which we're funding things.
That's really hopeful. And I'm very encouraged by the conversations that children have with me and are having with me and sort of young activists. Sort of earlier on in the series, I did one podcast with a 12-year-old climate activist and then a couple of weeks ago with two 15-year-olds. So there's, and I keep meeting these children and young people as well. Do you?
Yeah, isn't it great?
Yeah, it's amazing.
It makes me want to cry sometimes. I just, you know, they're just, because they're so hopeful and they're so angry as well, which is great.
But I think really that's a really interesting point. It took me a while to realise that those things, anger and hope, can coexist quite comfortably.
Because it's hopeful anger, that's the thing. It's anger, but it's not despair. It's they really do feel empowered to do something about it, and they clearly feel like they can change things, and that's fantastic. We're actually looking at setting up a youth panel at Trees for Cities. That's one of my projects at the moment. It's not happening yet. It's in planning, but we're going to try and launch that for National Tree Week, which is the last week of November. So that, I'm really looking forward to that. And I think, yeah, empowering young people, as we said at the start, it's the grisly details, being honest, being truthful, that does lead to hope, because you know what you're dealing with. And then, like Sir David Attenborough and a lot of people say, like, really got to present the truth of the situation. It's not looking good, everyone, but there's still room to be hopeful, and that's what propels people to do things.
But it's also the invitation. It's also saying, this is what you can do. For me, that's really important. So present the facts, say there's hope, but invite actions that, you know, so, because I think that's what the young people seem to want, and they're absolutely right. It's not just, you know, it's not crossing your fingers, is it? It's planting a tree. Yeah. So that's great. Does it feel to you like, in general, that tree planting is a hopeful thing to do? You've sort of spoken about it a little bit.
I think so. And I was thinking as well, it's not just the physical act of planting a tree, which is quite a satisfying thing because it's so concrete. It's also feeling part of that community on the day and beyond, and being able to say, oh, I'm a volunteer at this organisation, or belonging to that network is really valuable.
Yeah.
I hope that we can give that to people.
Oh, no, you definitely do, definitely. And what are your hopes for the future in terms of what might our Trees for Cities be able to do next over the next couple of years? We might know anyway, you might have it planned.
Oh, there's all kinds of business plans and things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's about greening as much as possible, including as many people as we can. We're definitely looking at mobilising communities. That's a term that's been used a lot. So strategically, we're keen to empower small community groups to do what they're doing without us necessarily doing the planting. So, for example, Deptford Folk, which you're part of, incredible community group, like one of the best ones I've encountered, really empowered and seriously impressive. Like, some of the stuff that's happened there I think is great, and we did come in to support some of the planting and boost it and help with delivery logistics, but ultimately that is the community group of Deptford Folk leading that making it happen. And there, what I would really love to see, and I think that lockdown will actually support this because it's connected people a lot more with their local communities and with their local green spaces. I think some new friends of groups and some new local park groups are going to emerge from this year. And hopefully we can equip those groups with the knowledge and the confidence and maybe a bit of funding to go and do their own greening projects in their neighbourhoods. So we don't necessarily need to be the ones that are going in, but we can provide resources and guidance and online stuff for people to do that. So strategically, we're heading in that direction.
Yeah, that's great. It feels like it makes it much more possible to grow quicker, doesn't it? And it's really empowering. Yeah. I know of a few groups that have sort of informally sprung up as well. People planting, planning on planting, or guerrilla gardening, a bit of that, and also cleaning up streams, lots of stuff. Because you know
the littering. Mm.
People have had time. Some people have had time in a way they haven't had time. So there are, dare I say it, some positives to come out of COVID. And this is a big one, Jess, for you. But for you, if you, Jess, could imagine a utopia, which is hard to imagine, and I also always think it's partly hard to imagine because the dystopian story is so culturally rich. We told so many stories of the other. So I think it's hard to think about utopia. But if you were to think of a utopian future or utopian-ish future, what would that look like for you? What changes would you like to see? What sort of world would you like to see?
You know what? The word that just springs to my mind is justice. I think it's the Black Lives Matter rhetoric, which obviously we all need to be thinking about every day. But it's also, when I think about nature, the more you work with nature, the more you're reminded that actually we live in a very stressful planet. Everything is constantly being eaten by another thing. Like, this is not some like kind of rosy merry-go-round of love. There's a lot of stressful stuff going on, but it's about the balance and it's about the opportunity for things to thrive. And, you know, it's that balance of stuff. And I think the human word justice comes into it at that point because everyone deserves an equal shot. Everyone deserves to be treated equally. We need to have balance. We need to have these opportunities. And I think that that's what I hope the direction in which we're going in. Obviously, it is a very stressful and confusing planet. We're living on this giant rock. No one really knows why. Lots of people have different ideas, which I think is great. Like, I love faith, but, you know, it's a varied narrative. So here we are. But yeah, I think that just like aiming to go towards, and this is why parks as well. I read an amazing article the other day that was just looking at the life in the day of a park. And you get all sorts of people in green spaces and cities, and we share that space together. So hopefully through the projects that we're doing, we're able to reach out to lots of different people in the same way.
Yeah, and have a future filled with justice and trees. Yes.
Yes.
Trees and equality, etc. So lastly, Jess, thank you so much for all of your time. If someone's listening and they're like, I really want to get involved with tree planting, I wanted to ask you this because I thought it might be different right now within the COVID landscape. But if somebody was in London listening to this, wanted to get involved with tree planting with Trees for Cities, first of all, how would they best get in touch? And can they do that right now? Can we do that right now? Or...
They can. So we've got a volunteer mailing list that's on our website, treesforcities.org. It's on the Get Involved page. You can still sign up to that. We're not actually doing wider volunteering opportunities at the moment because of COVID. We are offering very local family units and support units, planting workshops, but, you know, if they're very localised to the site. So if we're planting near you, hopefully you'll notice anyway, because we'll put up posters and you might hear about it through the various streams. But at the moment, we're not inviting people to travel into different neighbourhoods specifically. However, when that does change, hopefully we will be doing that again. So you can sign up to the mailing list and then you'll just sort of pick up any opportunities that happen.
That's brilliant. And what about, I don't know whether this is a tougher one for you to answer, but what about if someone's listening that's not in London or not in the, what's the first, or even not in the UK, what's a good sort of first point if you're like, how can I find out what's going on locally? Is it just to like a Google it, or is it contact local authority? Or
I think there are a few things. familiarise yourself with the nationwide or larger environmental organisations like the Conservation Volunteers and various different larger charities, RSPB, wildlife trusts, see what opportunities they've got going on. Then also head on to Twitter or Facebook. Even if you don't use these platforms, it's worth just Googling the name of your neighbourhood and seeing who comes up, because, for example, like Deptford Folk or these little community grassroots groups, there could be something in your area that you may not find on Google, but if you really search kind of localised on social media platforms, you might find them. And then from there, you can either join something they're doing or actually work with them to begin something, even if it's just a bit of daffodil planting. You know, councils are usually okay with, you know, like being able to begin something.
Yeah, that's great. That's very good advice. There's always something out there. There's always something going on. So yeah. That's brilliant. Thank you so much for your time, Jess, and all your work.
Really, you're nice, so welcome. I also just wanted to say that you've been an incredible support to the whole team. Bernadette has, you've given us so much time, so much love and support. You're an absolute joy. And, you know, you're really part of the team.
Oh, good.
It takes someone to rock up at a ridiculous hour in the morning on a Saturday in the freezing cold, often rain.
Honestly, it's been a consistent sort of joy to me, and apart from the fact that I've really enjoyed planting trees, the sort of people interaction, the sort of being reminded of how of the rich ecosystem of London is such a treat, like you said, it's so great.
Thank you as well.
I'll see you soon.
Thanks very much.
Bye.